Everyone, welcome back to the Peace and Liberty Podcast. I've obviously been taking a lot of time off because I'm working on a bunch of projects right now. It sounds silly, but I'm writing 3 books at the moment. I hope to have one published in the next few months, so be on the lookout. If you like the show, please donate to me at patreon.com/thepeaceandlibertypodcast. And in general, I'll be putting out at least 2 to 3 episodes a week from now on, but it's hard for me to commit to a schedule right now, considering I'm about to start a very tough college semester. Nevertheless, this week I'm going to discuss Austrian economics, and today in particular, I'm going to discuss the birth of Austrian economics. So to start, I'm going to recommend 2 pieces to get a good understanding of how Austrian economics evolved and what it is. And the first is a piece titled The Philosophical Origins of Austrian Economics by David Gordon. And the second is titled The Austrian School of Economics, the family album of the Ludwig-von-Mises Institute. You can see right behind me. Now, if you're new to all this, these 2 pieces will reflect a lot of what I'm about to say. And I'll link to both of these in the show notes. So the Austrian school arose in opposition to the German historical school in the 1880s. Many are familiar with G.W.F. Hegel, whose viewpoints played a key role in developing the strains of thought that was prominent in the 19th century. Hegel actually thought that property was essential, but he was utterly convinced of the doctrine known as the doctrine of internal relations. Basically, what this said is that everything that exists is bound by unity, meaning everything is related to everything else. A quick example of this is, say I decide to either go to the store or not go to the store today. Well, that's going to affect the rest of the world. So why does this matter? Well, it's important to remember that the German historical school, led by people such as Gustave Schmoller, Werner Sombart, Otmar Spann, they denied economic laws. For example, they didn't believe in things like supply and demand, or that, for example, other things equal, a raise in the minimum wage will lead to unemployment. They didn't agree with any of this. The Austrians would argue that you don't even have to test these things. We can deduce these unfalsifiable ideas. And the main unfalsifiable idea is that humans act. And the reason you can't say that humans don't act is because you act by making that assumption. So it'd be self-contradicting to say humans don't act. I'll briefly mention that a lot of people say that Adam Smith is the father of modern economics. Scholars like Rothbard disagreed. Richard Cantillon, who lived from 1680 to 1734, wrote a book called Essay on the Nature of Commerce in 1730. And this work has some true Austrian insights into it. I recommend reading it. The chapters are very short, sometimes a few sentences each. So how did Austrian economics evolve? Well, Franz Brentano was a professor of philosophy at the University of Vienna in the late 1800s, and he personally rejected the doctrine of internal relations. He held contempt for people like Immanuel Kant, Hegel. Most importantly, he recognized that thinking is an action. And this was one of the first Austrian insights, is that only individuals act. Only individuals act. So to briefly reiterate, the German historical school would argue that you can't separate out factors and look at cause and effects, but rather you always need to look at the big picture. And if you really think about that, science is impossible under those conditions. We don't have an infinite amount of knowledge, but rather we work with what we have. And yes, we have to deduce a lot of things. William Stanley Jevons, who is more of a proto-Austrian than anything, wrote a paper titled A Brief Account of a General Mathematical Theory of Political Economy. He wrote that in 1866. In this paper, he had a lot of great Austrian insights, and I recommend people read it, but the thing he got wrong is that he believes utility, and by the way, utility is just a fancy word for satisfaction or happiness. He believed that utility was measurable, meaning, for example, we should be able to objectively find how many utils a person gets out of a task or hobby or whatever. Just from the sound of it, you probably can sense why he was wrong, but it was really Karl Menger with his 1871 book, Principles of Economics, that the Austrian school was born. This book was revolutionary, and if you read it, Menger mentions that when he was writing it, he was ecstatic because he realized the contribution he was making was totally original. He provided a very sound analysis of marginal utility, which basically means that as the number of units of the good increases, the less value of any given unit will have. If you've ever heard of the law of diminishing returns, this means that the first unit of a good always satisfies the most immediate desires, and that you can still gain value from additional units, the value is increasing at a decreasing rate. And eventually, additional units of good will be a burden and won't satisfy any desires. Now, he also has this one other great book titled The Origins of Money, in which he argues that money arises from the market. It's not instituted by governments. Another book I recommend by Menger is called The Positive Theory of Capital, which he really gets into the idea that capital isn't homogeneous, which probably doesn't make sense to the viewers right now. if you study Austrian economics, you'll understand that. But it's the idea that capital is, in fact, heterogeneous. Eugen Bumbaverk, who was a student of Karl Menger, he made some very original contributions himself. For example, he applied Menger theories to value, price, capital, and interest. In 1884, he published his History and Critique of Interest Theories. I'll discuss this more next episode, but interest, in the view of the Austrians, is the most important price of the market. And when you artificially manipulate interest rates, you screw up the whole structure of production. Again, I'll go more into this next episode, but many of you probably already know what interest is. If I loan out $100 at 10% interest, I seek to get back $110. And the 10% rate in the example would be reflective of the state of the economy. So this isn't random. It's not a random percentage what people charge as interest. Now, Bumbaverk was a very important figure, and he actually served as finance minister in the Habsburg monarchy, where he, quote, fought for balanced budgets, sound money in the gold standard, free trade, and the repeal of export subsidies and other monopolies. One last book I'll recommend by him, though there's many others, is titled Marx and the Close of a System. It is a systematic destruction of Marxism from the labor theory of value to the transformation problem. The title of the book alone accurately represents what Bumbaverk argues. Now, there was one area where his analysis didn't extend to, and that was money. He understood that money emerged from the market, but it was really Ludwig von Mises who took on this challenge in his 1912 book titled The Theory of Money and Credit, which is a truly groundbreaking book. One of Mises' greatest contributions is the idea of the regression theorem, which basically shows why money has value today. And briefly, the reason why money has value today because it had value yesterday and the day before, etc. The regression theorem. The next point I'll make is, it's an important point, and most classical economists, especially with the onset of Keynesian economics, they all read economists in English. So Mises, who wrote in German, didn't get translated to English till much later. John Maynard Keynes, his most prominent work was titled The General Theory of Unemployment, Interest, and Money, and that was published in 1936. But it wasn't until 1934 that Mises' theory of money and credit was translated to English. By that time, it was too late. Keynes was a big believer in using the government as a steering wheel, per se, to direct the economy. He was a big opponent of savings in general. He called savings leakage. And when you hear people nowadays talk about rich people that hoard their money overseas, the Austrians would argue that they're saving their money for future investments. Well, Keynesians would argue that they're withholding money from the economy. Keynes had this fetish of the idea of full employment, meaning that we have a lot of idle resources lying around, and if we just put these resources to work, no matter what the work is, then this will be a boon to the economy. This is the same reason why Paul Krugman argues that if there was an imminent alien invasion about to occur, you can look this up, he's in a video saying this, this would be a big boost to the economy. Why? Because we would divert all our resources to building up infrastructure. And can you imagine how many jobs would be created if an alien space invasion was imminent? But back to Mises, he had a lot of groundbreaking books such as Socialism, which was published in 1921. And he would eventually go on to publish his magnum opus in 1949 titled Human Action. And of course, Human Action was what inspired Murray Rothbard to write Man, Economy, and State. Now, I'll talk about Hayek briefly. He was another very important figure. Funny enough, Hayek actually diverged from Mises in many respects, and he's on record having said many times that he always admired Mises, but found his arguments unpersuasive. Hayek was a big fan of falsification, which is kind of like a logical positivist theory. Still, when Mises found the Austrian Institute for Business Cycles Research, Hayek was put in charge of it. So over the course of decades, Hayek wrote dozens of books, including the book Road to Serfdom that was published in 1944. And this book was thought to have revived much of classical liberalism in the aftermath of World War II. Remember that even Keynesian economists nowadays argue that war is beneficial for the economy and that World War II was a great success in this respect. This is completely wrong, but this is what they argue. Another quick fact about Mises and Hayek, they both had to flee the Nazis. Hayek left Austria in 1931, and in 1934, Mises moved to Geneva, where he wrote Human Action. The Nazis actually confiscated all of Mises' work that he left behind in his apartment, and there was a myth that the Nazis burned his books. This didn't happen. They actually took his books and put them away, and in 1992, they were discovered in archives in Moscow. By all means, Mises in the Austrian school was a huge threat to fascism and Nazism. Talk about denying economic laws. That's kind of the basis of Nazism, to deny economic laws, that the state, you know, decides what the laws are. The last Austrian economist I'll mention, and I've left a few out for the sake of the discussion to keep it short, is Murray Rothbard. If you ever watched my show, you know he's my favorite economist of all time. I have like every single book he's ever written. He's written thousands upon thousands of articles. I think he's written a few dozen books himself. His analysis in the book, America's Great Depression, published in 1963, made a very compelling case that the Great Depression was caused by the tinkering of the money supply through central banks. I mentioned Man, Economy, and State earlier, which is right behind me. That's his magnum opus, and it added many insights to Mises' Human Action. Personally, I think his most impressive achievement was his four-volume book series titled Conceived in Liberty. And if you look behind me, the top shelf, top left shelf, you'll see it's a monster book. It covers the entirety of the colonial period up through the present. Now, we could have a whole discussion about Henry Hazlitt, John Baptiste Say, and all these amazing other economists, but I hope today's episode's been helpful in understanding the main figures related to the birth of the Austrian school. Tomorrow, I'll go in depth and talk about what is Austrian economics. And if y'all could donate to me on Patreon to keep the show going, that would be amazing. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. As always, for Peace and Liberty. See you tomorrow.